Thank you for coming. I'd like to thank Faber for the opportunity to present and for allowing me to fill in for Pat Kilgore at the last minute. He's the one who made the slides in the presentation. He's back in Atlanta with the group. So here I am. So the talk today is about classical sabermetrics versus formal statistical inference. And we're going to talk about some of the differences between the two approaches to baseline analytics and how they can work together to kind of come to a more unified approach to quantitative baseline research. And then we'll look at some different examples of a few different approaches. First of all, a little bit about baseball research. One of the really great things is that anyone can do baseball research. There's plenty of data available out there online. Sometimes it can be a little tricky to get exactly the data in the right form that you want, but it's all out there. And there's lots of support within the sabermetric community. Traditionally, baseball enthusiasts and not people working within the game have been the ones to make the largest contributions to sabermetrics. And one of the really interesting things is that in no other business sector has there ever been more influenced by outsiders and laymen than in baseball. So one of the points Pat brought up that was kind of interesting is that usually business culture changes from within. And one of the unique things about baseball is that people can come from outside of the industry and have some impact on the analytics. So here's the giant baseball research melting pot. Pat said this slide took him 3 hours to make, so I'll leave it there for a second. We can all admire it. His point here is that anyone can really get into baseball research. We have academics, economists, MBAs, editors, lawyers, night watchmen, engineers, statisticians. Personally, last year I kind of stumbled into baseball research. I was working on a master's at a public health school. My original thesis that was health related kind of fell through, so Pat Kilgore gave me the HFX data set, and towards my biostatistics degree, I was able to do kind of some advanced programming with the HFX data set. So that's my background. I came from a public health perspective, and Pat has a similar background. So I just think it's kind of interesting that anyone can really get involved with this. So there are different perspectives out there. When we have such a variety of backgrounds all coming together, there can be tensions and different opinions that conflict. So everything in the melting pot, we can basically boil it down to two distinct areas. First, we have the classical sabermetrics, and then we have formal statistical inference. So first, the inferentialist default view of sabermetrics. They kind of tend to think of them as people who don't have enough experience with real data analysis. They take an ad hoc approach to statistical analysis, and they lack the formal training and qualifications that are required to really make sense of some of the more advanced models. And then we have the sabermetricians and the ways that they view inferentialists. So they think that these are people who have little or no feel for the game, their methods are fancy and unnecessary, they may spend too much time on studies that are impractical and don't really have any meaning for outcomes in the game. No appreciation for previous sabermetric advances. They may tend to reject informal discussion, so they say, okay, we're going to do this analysis, publish it, that's it. We don't want to talk about how it actually may impact the game. And then they may come off as haughty and attack some of the credentials of their So here are just some generalizations about the two groups. We want to make the point that this is not clear cut. So here we have tables with two columns. There can be some crossing over in between the columns. So first, classical sabermetrics. People who work there tend to be hobbyists and baseball enthusiasts, whereas people who do formal statistical inference come from a more academic background. In classical sabermetrics, people tend to love the game like the math, whereas in formal statistical inference, it's more that you like the game and love the math. So just some different terminology. When you're working with classical sabermetrics, you have a lot more baseball jargon that you're working with. Like wind shears, war, OPS, etc.
just want to play both.
So, to decision making based on samples requires a probabilistic basis. There are kind of two different philosophies within statistics. We have the frequentists, who rely on p-values, confidence intervals, uncertainty. And then the Bayesians, who rely more on posterior probabilities, credibility, and admissibility. There are plenty of debates that go on between those two groups. I'm not going to get into that. The main point here is that both of these philosophies are based on probabilistic evidence gathering from random samples. In baseball, though, we're never going to have a random sample. We have a census. We have all of the data. We could turn it into a random sample by drawing certain observations out of the entire data set, but then we're just losing information, so there's really no point in doing that.
Is a census not essentially a random sample of all things that might have happened? You know, we're talking about entities such as players who have unknown but inherent statistical profiles about them that is not what actually happens in real life. A sample, perhaps not well controlled, but a random sample of how those inherent tendencies manifest.
I guess you could think of it that way. When we say a census, we're looking at everything that actually happened, and we have information on everything that has actually happened. So I don't know of any other case where you would take into account things that theoretically could happen but didn't. It's a good point.
Looking for a predictive model, then we want to know what the underlying characteristics of such a model. You can know that all the time is the evidence of harmless.
Right, so I'll get into this in a few slides, actually. So we can take our data from the census and use it to make a prediction about something that's going to occur in the future, which I think is kind of different from saying, okay, we're going to take our census and treat it as a sample of everything that could have theoretically happened in the past. Okay. Most studies having to do with baseball are best considered observational. However, they're usually treated as experimental. So when we do an experimental study, we really do rely on the random sample assumption. Just to be fair, though, the random sample assumption does get trampled on in just about every research sector known to us. So if you think about it, say, okay, I'm going to take a random sample. That sounds easy enough, right? But in reality, it's actually pretty difficult to come up with a random sample. So like I said, in baseball research, we have all of the data. So this is kind of a dilemma. What are we going to do? Quantities like p-values, most research decision-making processes really rely on p-values, technically they're meaningless for a census. The observed effects in a census are the truth, so really there's no need to make probabilistic inferences anymore. So who would do something like this? We did. And when I say we, this is Pat Kilgo and some other colleagues at Emory. This was a study on the Mitchell Report they presented at a paper convention a few years ago. So what they did here was they basically took a bunch of different potential predictors, built a regression model. The outcome they were looking at was the percent increase due to steroids, increase in home runs. So here are just some of the different models they looked at. The point here isn't to get all caught up in the data. But what they were doing is they took all of the data from the census and wrote up this study, and it was published in Chance in the Journal of Quantitative Analysis and Sports and some other peer-reviewed, very well-known journals. So the take-home message here is that, yes, for any inferential statistical procedure, we do have these assumptions, and you know, sometimes the assumptions are valid, and sometimes they're not, and sometimes it's okay to violate the assumptions a little bit. Okay. So if the probabilistic basis for a p-value is not there in a census, is there any use for inferences? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And it may not be very clear when the answer is yes or when it's no. I think you have to kind of look at the research question that you're aiming to answer and then make a decision based on that. So there are two streams of research with a whole lot of gray area in between. So on the top, we've got purely descriptive and deterministic research. I think the key difference between the top and the bottom of this slide is the uncertainty. So there's kind of a trade-off when we look at uncertainty. When we're doing purely descriptive research, there is no uncertainty because we look back at the data, we calculate our mean, our percentage, whatever we're interested in. In purely descriptive analysis, it's probably useless or even misleading to calculate or report the uncertainty just because we have all of the data. The research questions for descriptive research are usually easy to answer and they have a completely correct answer. So we do a calculation based on all of the available data and there's our answer. So for example, we could look at how many strikeouts someone threw in a certain season. So the answer is fixed, it's knowable, it's something that we can look up. And at the bottom of this slide, we have inferential and predictive analysis. There we have rampant uncertainty, and it's critical to calculate and report this uncertainty. The research problems that we're looking at are often hard, and they only have approximate answers. So when we're looking at inference, it's not just something where we can look back at historical data and calculate the answer. And so an example of this would be trying to predict a certain batter's batting average for the next season. So this is something that is random. We don't know the answer, and we have to do some research and maybe play with some interactions or confounders and different variables in order to come up with the best answer. Okay. There are four common baseball research designs that we're going to discuss, and I'll give an example of each one. First, we have purely descriptive analysis, which is usually based on a census. Then we've got inferential analysis based on a sample. And then we can mix the two approaches. We can have a mixture of descriptive and inferential approaches from a census. And there are two purposes to this. We could do an associative model, which aims to establish a cause-and-effect relationship. Or we could do a predictive model, which is where we want to estimate a future performance. So here's example number one, a purely descriptive analysis. Pat Kilgore presented this at the Sabre Convention in Long Beach last summer. And his research question was whether or not umpires give preferences to veterans to call balls and strikes. So what he found was that there was a higher call strike rate for veteran pitchers compared to less experienced pitchers, and a lower call strike rate for veteran hitters compared to less experienced, and vice versa with the false call rate. So here's kind of the main result of his study. So what he did was he took the pitcher experience and the batter experience, divided it up into one-year categories, and then he looked at all of the false balls and false strikes. Here we're looking at false strikes. And he calculated the percentage out of all of the pitches from the 2010 regular season. So what he found, if you look at the upper right corner there in the red box, so there we see a lot of the very pale green. So if you look down at the bottom of the key, that is the lowest rate of false strikes. So we see that when the batter is very experienced, and he's facing a very inexperienced pitcher, he's likely to have a very low false strike rate. And then if you look in the lower left corner, we have inexperienced batters facing very experienced pitchers, and we see the highest false strike rate. And then when we look at a combination of the two, so a very experienced batter going up against a very experienced pitcher, we see kind of a good mix of the light, medium, and dark shade of green. So there's really no impact when we have an experienced batter facing an experienced pitcher. And so these are just some of the findings. This is an example of a purely descriptive analysis. So what Pat did was he took the data from the 2010 regular season and he calculated these percentages. We're not making predictions about anything that's going to happen in the future. We're not accounting for any other outside variables. We're just calculating these percentages based on the variables that we're presenting. So this was preferences for the best pitchers and similar statistics for the best batters. Okay, so that was a descriptive approach. There's some strings. one is easily comprehended by a general audience. At the Sabre convention, not everyone there is a statistics person. We've just got a lot of kind of general baseball fans. So without going too deep into regression modeling or anything complicated and inferential, we were able to do a descriptive study and present the results in a way that was easy to understand by the general audience. Here we can assume that probably is a fair estimate of causality. The results of these studies usually conform to our intuition, and they're reproducible and accountable. One kind of interesting thing about this study was that Pat said that within about a week of when he presented it, he had heard from several different outside people who had taken the data and verified his results. So that's one of the great things about the sabermetric community, is that it's available to everyone. The data are out there, so someone can do a research study, present it, and then anyone else out there who's interested in the same area can take the data and reproduce the study. Now the weaknesses. First of all, it does not address all the possible causes of the result. So the only thing we took into account was the years of experience. So for example, we didn't look at maybe the star power of the players. So if someone was an all-star pitcher who was very experienced, versus another very experienced pitcher who maybe didn't have as great of a career, that's an example of something we didn't take into account. So all we looked at was how long the player had been playing in the major leagues. And the second thing is that this does not generalize to a setting greater than that in which it was calculated. So like I said, we can't make any inferences into the future. We can't predict anything. This is purely a retrospective study. We're looking at what happened in 2010, and we cannot extrapolate any further in the future.
But if you did it all past,
we still could do that if we had the data, but we still...
Sort of like with the samples.
In inference, you can do everything right and still get the wrong answer sometimes. So when we're building our model, if we use the selection criterion of 5% or 10% for our alpha value, that's saying that we have a 5 or 10% chance of making a type 1 error. So we might include something in our model as being significant that actually in the real world is not significant. It was just a random chance that that ended up being significant in the model. This is a fairly uncommon design in baseball research. It's useful, but what we tend to see more of is the purely descriptive. And then we've got two examples of mixed methods. First, we're going to look at associative processes. So for an associative model, we want to kind of look at the outcome and see what factors come into play in shaping that outcome, the different values. So here we've got some quotes from Tim McCarver during a playoff broadcast 4 years ago. This is paraphrased, but he said something along the lines of, "Catchers have four at-bats as the game wears on because their hand gets sore." And then during the 2009 All-Star game, Joe Mauer batting, "Catchers will often have their third, fourth, and fifth plate appearances be throwaway at-bats." So we're going to look at some data and see what we've got. So our research question here is, do catchers really have four at-bats as the game wears on? To examine this question, we can look back and use all of the available data from previous seasons. So we're going to use the census. Descriptive statistics are not enough to get the cause-effect relationship. So we can't just look at the different at-bats and see what happened and make conclusions. We have to take into account some other outside variables. And here, meaningful model-based adjustments are possible, even if probabilistic inferences are mostly meaningful. So what we did building the model was we had to take into account some potential confounders. So here on the left, we've got a list of confounders and then some possible model-based adjustments we can make on the right-hand side. So the things we accounted for were the pitching changes, the number of pitches thrown, the player quality, season length, player age, player experience, and the different pitcher-batter matchups. And the pitcher-batter matchup, that's a categorical variable that's not ordinal, so it was dummy-coded to account for the quarter confounders. Team plate appearances, number of batters faced, and player age were modeled with quadratic terms to account for the non-linearity in the relationship. So this is going back to your question before, I think. This is a study done by Pat Kilder, so we have all the methodology there. It turned out that the key variable in the model was the interaction term between the team play appearances and the defensive position. So here we've got a graph of the estimated probability of home run, and we've got a curve for each defensive position. And on the x-axis, we kind of progress through the game. So we've got the number of team play appearances on the x-axis. So what do we notice in this graph? So we've got the estimated probability of home runs, and the catchers, they're pretty low down in terms of the rank of the field position, but they don't really decrease at all during the game. They stay pretty constant, and if you look at all the other positions, they're the ones that tend to decrease more. And then if you look at the estimated probability of a hit throughout the game, you see that once again, catchers start out pretty low at the beginning of the game, but they actually decrease less relative to all the other players. And so when we see the different curves crossing over, that's what we mean by the interaction term between the team plate appearances and the defensive position. So there's a different effect of the number of team plate appearances based on which position the player.
You mentioned that you might be right.
think only individuals in that table.
Well, you can tell us, we need to be monitoring to do that. Everyone do things like show us, in a very surprising way. Are you going to tell us then, people can make physical statements, box calls, or phrases, or you got to do that?
So all we're doing here is we're taking a previously published study as an example. If you, I'm sure it's online somewhere.
Okay.
I thought so too, actually. Sorry about that. It only gives you 30 minutes. Okay. So here's the real interesting part. So when we make that adjustment for the plate appearances, we see that the top curve is the catcher, and so I'm sorry, this is where we adjust for the batting order. So the top curve is the catcher, and we see that curve for the entirety of the graph is above the other curve, position number 10, so the DH. So this was just our conclusion. And it illustrates the importance of accounting for the different contenders. So when we look at the batting order, that was kind of the key adjustment we had to make.
Excuse me. What would be the rise of the drops here? There's quite a few there, of course, in the game.
Yes, okay. So Pat explained this to me yesterday, actually, because I had the same question. So you'll see that there's a peak every 9 plate appearances, so it accounts for the 9 players in the batting order. So we're just saying that
catcher is closer to the front of the order, is a better thing.
Right, yeah. So not every catcher is going to show up at the same place.
I got you.
Yeah. Where was this published?
I'm sure it was. I actually don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't find that out. I'm assuming it was at a Sabre convention somewhere. That's where Pat usually.
Not in the statistics.
It may have been. So Pat and I are biostatisticians at Emory University. So we come at this from the biostatistics standpoint and not so much the baseball world. Okay, so I have 10 more minutes. I'm going to try to get through this. So our conclusion here was that Tim McCarver was mostly wrong.
Amazing.
So I was on the phone with Pat last night, and I got to this slide, and I said, okay, am I going to offend anyone in the audience by saying Tim McCarver was mostly wrong? And he said, no, they will all laugh. There we go. So what we saw was no evidence of disproportionate performance decline for catchers, and what we actually saw was that they tended to perform better towards the end of the game relative to some of the other field position players. We also saw that they're the most consistent players, so not only did they not decline, but even though they started out a little bit lower than the other positions, they were more consistent. So the take-home message here is that we were able to adjust for other competing explanations, and this was the major strength of doing an associative inferential study here. So now we get to the strengths and weaknesses. We can account for repeated measures, so correlation due to the same person. What we mean by this is that when we take a big sample of all the plate appearances, we can't just treat it as a random sample because all the ones that come from the same player are going to be correlated. So that's an example of a repeated measures study, and we can account for that with our associative inferential model. And then the ability to control for confounders, as we saw here, was huge. So when we adjusted for the batting order, we saw that the catcher, that peak curve for the catchers was actually above the curve for the DH. Weaknesses, the audience had to take our word for it. That happened right here. So you're saying, Berman is published, I want to see it. and you know, you can see it, you can read through the methodology, but there's in a presentation, there's just not enough time to explain everything. So we can present our results, but when we're doing something complicated that's an inferential method like this, you've got to take our word. And then the whole issue of the gray area using these methods in so that was mixed methods for associative purposes. Now we have mixed methods for predictive purposes. So what we're doing here is we're going to use a model-based approach on a census to predict a future performance. This is useful in applying uncertainty levels to predictions that are made from a census. So for example, we might predict 25 win shares with confidence bounds of 20 to 30. So this is something that we're predicting in the future, so there's some uncertainty associated with our prediction. And then we've got the very gray area. First thing is just gray, now it's very gray, I guess. Not theoretically clear how uncertainty quantities generated from a probability basis applies to it. So we keep coming back to this assumption that we may or may not be predicting. So here's example number 4. This is a steroid study, so this is the one I was talking about before that Pat presented at the DC Sabre Convention. He just wanted to make the point that when he wrote it up and published it, there were several limitations of the study that were admitted up front. But I guess his point here is that kind of one of the weaknesses of inferential analysis is that if you're a baseball fan and you come read this article, because that's kind of who our target audience is, you might not necessarily read through all the methodology and limitations. You want to skip to the results and the discussion and get to the interesting part. So even if we do write up a study and mention all of the limitations, the whole audience isn't necessarily going to read that. So that's another shortcoming of inferential analysis. And then he says that the estimates of uncertainty still have some validity on what might happen in the future if steroid use continues. So there were 12 different models that they're in. And these are the results here. So the circles represent the truth. That was the value that came out of the model. And then the horizontal lines on either end, those are prediction data. So what we're doing here is we're looking at a census of past data, and then we're going to use our model to make a prediction. So those are the circles. And then we're saying, okay, this is just a prediction, so inherently there's going to be some uncertainty. You usually hear about confidence intervals. Here we're working with prediction bands, which are a little bit different. Prediction bands are saying, okay, we are going to make a prediction on one player in the future. Whereas with a confidence interval, it would be more of the mean outcome for a group of people that had similar characteristics. So here we've got prediction bands. We're taking our census, using a model, and we're going to make a prediction for what's going to happen in the future. So what we're doing is we're taking the best from both approaches. Classical Sabre metrics are easy to understand, usually lead to correct inferences, and how are these statistical revolution in baseball. The formal statistical inference, it gives us the ability to get better estimates via adjustments. We can make inferences from sample-based analysis as possible, as we saw in the business study. And we've got better pre-hoc accounting for underlying data structures, accounting for correlations. And here's just kind of a conclusion. In our opinion, we don't want to overvalue the p-value. So the p-value really relies on that random sample assumption, which we generally don't meet in baseball research. We can still use the p-value, but you know, don't over rely on it. Don't overvalue it. Don't overvalue the academic peer review process in the baseball research setting. The issue here is that journal editors see the final product, and that's it. They have no oversight as to the conduct of the study beyond commenting on what is written. They usually don't have access to the data source, nor are they inclined to investigate it. So for example, the pinch effects data, it's out there. It may take a little bit of work to get it. But a journal editor from the statistical journal isn't going to go off and search the data to validate our results. So we can do a study and publish it, but they're kind of taking our word for what results come out.
Of course,
that's
like true that
I think it is true. Especially at Emory, I do a lot of work in clinical trials. And if it's a trial for a drug or something life-altering, they actually have an independent academic statistician who has to come in and verify the results before it can be sent off to the journal. So I do some work in clinical trials, and I'm on one right now where before it can be sent off for publication, we have to have an outside statistician come in and validate the results based on the data set. Just because for a new drug, if they don't do that before it's published, we can't be throwing up new drugs.
I work in this field. In general, drug standards, as you say, have to be much higher, only in the drug field than I imagine. It takes time and money. It takes, and you're doing it for free, so I understand that.
Yes.
And you're a new board. So it's, well, I referee hundreds of papers, and you never would be talking to these things.
There you go. Yeah, so I mean, they are different worlds. So, with the drug, we might be harming people if we do something incorrect and they don't validate our results. With baseball,
that's number
it's
two on the list.
But we're not
going to
be killing
people. But I'm talking about real life. I've got hundreds of publications. It's one thing. It's very much work. And there's other things to do with it.
So peer review, and use peer people, and determine that they did the right thing, but they didn't check it.
it's the methodology that they're checking.
Well, it's more like the things you can look at are, assuming it's not really done right, what does it mean? What I think is going to be wrong.
Assuming it was done right.
Yep. Oh, great.
The approach is to look more at the methodology. It's a little bit of a distinction. You're more interested in the methodology than you are in the actual.
Yeah. Go back to them for way back to the beginning of the The right-hand side of the first talk about basically databases and statistical packages, which are assumed to have correct identification of all the theory. I didn't see it there in mathematical analysis. And I'm wondering why it's missing. Is it means in statistics? Is it general purpose package or is it any kind of package or placebo? And so database analysis, I guess, I saw
I guess that's a question for the audience. I don't use Mathematica, I use R and SAS.
Someone calls up to describe formula, and then it takes the data and does the exposure to get an answer.
Does it do okay with very large data?
Sure. Yes, it's kind of what you were trying to call it, thinking about being a model or something like that. It would probably be easy. But it seems to matter what the status is. It's not that it gives you the ability to vote on any model. But if you're just a status model, for example, in drug trials, we're very ultimate. In drug trials, if you look at time courses, you look at dynamic processes, you look at where stuff goes, and so on. But usually, it's driven by what the data are, what the data are, what the time of data is.
And what's the data? What is that? 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 What is that?
connections to those people approaches is actually what it's on. Health insurance, you know, special services. You have something called credibility theory. There's a lot of ad hoc procedures that just show the lives of the same individuals. There's also a lot of
So just some more conclusions. We pretty much said all this before. Baseball research seldom meets the conditions for formal inference, mostly because of that random sample assumption that we're pretty much violating over time. Many research problems where the optimal solutions are debatable. One of the things about statistics is two different people can answer the same question two different ways. So, you know, sometimes you just really don't know the best way to go about solving. Sabermetric approaches seldom can fully interrogate cause and effect. So that was what we saw with the interaction and confounding terms in our associative model. And then formal statistical approaches provide estimated effects which should be closer to the truth than classical descriptive estimates. And then these are some suggestions that I came up with. If you would like to see the statistical analysis committee of Saber kind of step up and do a little bit more, provide an advisory board made up of individuals who understand the different intricacies between descriptive analyses and formal inferential studies and when each situation might be a little bit more appropriate. Emulate the sabermetric peer review process. So fact-checking an open debate instead of just sending things off to peer review journals where they're just going to kind of check it off and never talk about it again. We'd like to see kind of a more baseball-oriented peer review process. And then turn down the salary, have some fun. We're just trying to enjoy a hobby. So I think there he's getting it, kind of some of the tension between sabermetricians and inferentialists. Thank you very much.
Getting back to what we can do with census, because I'm really curious how this fits into a career that I got a degree in and ignored. How you see it. So, if we see that up until 1978, career tracks never take a trajectory. And then we see in 1978.